The next case is 97-1054, State of Ohio versus Daniel Wilhelm.
That's a defensive trial, it's pretty good, really good.
Yeah, it's probably good.
Doing a nice job, but we're there.
Mr. Giuliano?
Thanks, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Jeffrey Giuliano, Assistant Prosecutor in the Public County Prosecutor's Office in Hamilton. I would like to reserve 7 minutes for rebuttal.
Watch your time.
Please.
You need to watch your time on the clock.
Okay.
Is this case governed by Dayton versus Erickson?
I believe it is, Your Honor.
Well, all this driver did is went a little bit off the line on the right side of the road, never went across the center line. Does any weaving constitute Dayton versus Erickson?
Your Honor, I believe that the weaving in this case is substantial. It was more than just a little bit over the line on one occasion. It was weaving over the line on three separate occasions over a very short period of time that the officer observed, saw him go over, and he described it as swerving.
Is there a specific ordinance that governs the line next to the berm?
There's a state statute that covers that. That's fair to drive within Martin Lane, 45-11-33.
So, if I don't stay, if my left tire goes over the yellow line in the middle, or my right tire goes over the white line on the middle, and that man back there is following me,
well,
I can be charged and Dayton versus Erickson applies.
I think it applies here in this case, because the facts are that this individual went over the line, and both of his tires went over the line once, and then there was a swerving back, and then he went a little bit further, and he swerved over both of his tires again, he swerved back, and immediately went back over again.
Well, clearly, if it's a violation, the case is over, you do it by entry on Dayton case.
That's right.
We said it almost simultaneously with the U.S. Supreme Court.
Right, and I believe that that's what the law should be in regard to this case.
Did the U.S. Supreme Court say it should be more than, you don't need three swerves, do you? You're arguing that you need three swerves. Does it just say a violation of statute? Wouldn't one be only for the articulable suspicion?
That's correct.
You might not be drunk, you know, but you may be stopped. Is that the only point?
It's an articulable suspicion that this person has violated a traffic law.
Right.
And you could be pulled over for that under those two cases, the U.S. versus Renner, Dayton versus Erickson case. And that's what we would argue here. That's the case in this situation. Now, you know, I'm not going to get into the niceties of whether or not one that drift over the line would be good enough to show a violation of that statute. But in this case, if there's certainly enough, based upon the crossings of the line, and I would ask that the court set time on that. One of the things that bothered me about this decision from the Court of Appeals was that they found that the officer somehow caused this person to weave over the line by following behind him a couple of car lengths. And if you would look at the record in this case, the historical facts would show that that's not the case at all. That this individual, after he went up the road a little bit, the officer put on his overhead lights, continued to go, didn't even stop, didn't even know that the officer was behind him at that point. So I would argue that the trial court or the appellate court here erred in the way they interpreted the historical facts of this case. And I would ask that you find that, because I think that's true in this particular case. There's no evidence that there was any potholes in the road, there was any obstructions. This person was going down a standard width road and was within his lane of traffic. And and look at the trial court's findings of fact in this case. Their findings of historical facts were correct, and they properly overruled this motion to suppress on the proper standard of whether or not the officer had probable cause to pull this person over for a traffic violation and an articulable suspicion to also pull him over for a traffic violation, and also an articulable suspicion that he could have been under the influence of alcohol. So I would ask that you find that and reverse the opinion of the Court of Appeals in this case. I'm going to sit down now.
Thank you.
Deserve that my time. Thank you.
Mr. Miller. I noticed that even in your statement of facts, you said that the defendant swerved.
Well, that's what the record indicates.
Yeah.
There's no question he swerved three times over the white line.
Why wouldn't that even Erickson, notwithstanding, or I mean Erickson, you don't even need Erickson, do we, to find probable cause or articulable suspicion to stop somebody who does that?
Before Erickson, although that before post-Erickson,
yeah.
Before Erickson, the courts seem to take a overall look at what the circumstances were, the totality of the circumstances under Bobo. And the court would come down to counting the number of weekends and how far over, and how long they remained over, and speed, all these good factors. Certainly with Brandon, which the United States Supreme Court advanced Erickson, you don't need to count the violations or the number of potential violations. As long as there is any violation, that's enough cause to stop the car. I don't think there's a question about that. The Court of Appeals in this case said, though, that there was not necessarily a marked violation just because the vehicle was the right line a few times. Because it's not a per se violation, because the statute states that you can, as long as you can ascertain this practicality that you can go outside your lane, that's not a violation. It's not as if it's a carrier to signal, which is the language that was in the map. That's a clear violation of the statute, and that's not possible right there. The North Main violation is not all that clear.
Can't you just get away completely from a marked lane technical violation to the fact that this guy's physical actions of swerving caused great alarm to the officer? Regardless, I mean, he could have been even within his lane and doing that swerving within his lane to cause great
concern.
Either way, you stop him.
He gave him a break, didn't he?
Well, he was.
He thought, well, maybe the first time he just, you know, he was nodding, maybe, or he lost. He looked at his radio and the alternative, but three times.
Exactly. And I think that's why the Court of Appeals tells the way it is, because there are reasons why people swore about the land. Could have been the radio or letting the cigarette.
But after the third time, it seems to me that the trooper or the officer has some reason to stop the person and find out why it is they're swerving before he's swerving at somebody else. That's the point, isn't it?
But the thing is, Your Honor, he did not stop it. He waited an additional 20-30 seconds before deciding to stop it. And during that 20-30 seconds, Mr. Wellman drove, according to the record, absolutely perfect.
Even a drunk driver gets it right part of the time. If not, they'd be in the ditch. I mean, they wouldn't drive at all, but they do get it right part of the time, don't they?
That's why the court felt the need to look at the overall circumstances.
When you look at the overall circumstances, you have some risk-benefit analysis. If an officer watches three times square and says, okay, I'm not going to stop it, then the guy goes left again and hits the car head on. I mean, that you look at that risk versus stopping him, seeing that he's just, you know, looking at the TV or the radio, so he was swerving to the left, letting it go, versus stopping him and smelling alcohol and saying, oh, I was right, my suspicion. I mean, there's a reason for suspicion, there's a reason to stop him. And I think in this case, the harm for not stopping him from doing that should far outweigh the risk.
Yes, but as I said, the officer did not stop him, by the way.
So 30 seconds is being so significant, when he's not. So he follows him for a few more feet before he stops him. That's a great, you know, maybe he followed him 10 miles, but he didn't. 30 seconds doesn't carry much weight for me.
Well, as during that 30 seconds, there was no further weaving, then I crossed the center line at any time. He went through two traffic lights, both at each, and he even stood on the turn. And I know the state has made a great deal about the Court of Appeals finding that the police have provoked this, and I have to agree that...
Maybe he's seen the officer by now, he's really trying hard to be good.
Well, I agree with the state, that the record seems to indicate that he did not, was not even aware that the officer's present, so the officer turned on the siren. He had turned on the lights initially, and he was alone to himself until the siren.
So you disagree with the provocation?
Yes, I do. I don't think, from the basis of this record, that there was a provocation by the police.
Absolutely, aren't there a couple of other reasons not to stop immediately, particularly if there is a lot of oncoming traffic or an officer is immediately worried about a crash and trip. One being that officer might want to be running a license plate before the next stop, so additional hazard when you walk up to the car. And second, I assume the more normal being, well, I've seen enough here to have probable cause to stop, but if I wait a little more, I might see some more things that really help me nail this guy when we get to the point of trial. Because any officer has to be thinking about two things, probable cause to stop, and secondly, what am I going to be able to testify to when we go in here and try to get a conviction of the time to testify to?
Certainly, I'm checking the license plate, and I believe, and I can't say for the survey, I believe you cannot check the license plate until after you go on.
Okay, I don't see it in the record, so I assume that's the case.
In fact, he called in another officer to help him. I think it's also important to understand this particular police officer's first DUI stop. He had received his training only a month or so before. So it's not the experience of the officers that talked about somebody.
Turns out he wasn't wrong.
Well, he stopped the car. He wasn't wrong, he had to come down. But at the time that he stopped the car, he told he wasn't aware of what particular problem was.
I assume when you see this kind of driving, you may walk up and find that the driver's drowsy as well. So I assume officers stop a fair number of people where they observe this kind of driving, that they don't end up ticketing or any of
that. I understand that. I also think there's a problem with the facts that what happened, because assuming that the rail was going 35 miles an hour, the record doesn't indicate what the speed was. To swerve three times within 10 yards and 10 feet, I don't think that's possible in the dental swerving that was described by the police officer, 2 to 3 inches off the line.
Maybe that's something dangerous.
If you went 2 to 3 inches on the right side, I think the length between the swerves and the chest would be considerably a lot longer.
I know, I saw that. I was looking around to see
what was going on.
Maybe they got lucky and made that
stop.
Killed the Lorraine officer or something.
For all those reasons, Your Honor, I think the inspectorate process for us to form the decision to trial because I think the trial court does correct and it's something to say.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Mr. Eichel, you have almost 10 minutes.
I am Dan Eichel, Assistant Prosecutor of Butler County. Just as a personal note, 364 days ago, I was before this court arguing a capital case with the Attorney General as my co-counsel. But I think this case is just as important. That's why we're here. It's an important principle that a public court should strive to clarify the legal principles and unify precedent. We have a case here that we asked the Court of Appeals to certify because it's in conflict with, as we pointed out at the time of our motion, Court 2 of all districts, the 4th District and the 9th District. As this court saw in the previous case, Ninth District and Twelfth District have disagreed on that legal issue now before the court in Quantico. But today, we have a case where identical facts arise in these districts and are decided differently. After a motion in the court below, I found we have conflicts between our case and not only the Fourth District and the Ferris case, which I would submit as identical to the decision in the Fourth District, and also the Ninth District and the Horn case and the Anderson case. But I also found two more cases in my research. The Hyler case cited from the Second District, and the Easter case, which is from the Third District. Only, in my research, only the 11th District seemed to agree with the 12th District's analysis that we could look at these Mark Twain violations as some kind of de minimis violation and search the record for some type of extreme erratic driving. The court below refused to certify our case, stating that they dismissed the other cases that I found to be in conflict as involving more erratic driving. I said that's not correct if you look at the facts of the Ferris case in particular. But we do have erratic driving here. We have the swerving and the weaving in the lane. The officer described this swerving as direct testimony, weaving on cross-examination. We have three crossings across the berm line. The United States Supreme Court said best in the O'Hornellis case that such varied results in the interpretation of the Fourth Amendment and the intrusion on privacy, the traffic stop in the case, such varied results would be inconsistent with the idea of the unitary system of law. This, as a matter of course, would be unacceptable. That's why we're here. The appellee would have this court affirm the 12th District decision that tells police officers that a Mark Twain violation is de minimis, a violation of Verizon Code statute applicable across the line. It's a minor traffic violation, a minor law, unworthy of enforcement. We submit that the Erickson case decided that issue, explicitly used the word minor, that probable cause is seen that a minor violation has occurred. Traffic stop is reasonable. And that, as well, the court's opinion in Erickson indicated not only the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution, but the Constitution of Ohio. Of course, as Robinette, you know, they're interpreted, unless there's a reason contrary, they're basically interpreted the same thing. We have a case today. This is not like the court doesn't have a concern in this case that it had in Robinette case. We don't have a drug interdiction control. We don't have the record in this case. The first words of the police officer's mouth after he asked for the driver's license and health card, driver's card, Canada. First words out of the officer's mouth are, "I stopped you for weaving across the burn line for you." Mark Twain violations. Sole reason here. There's no hint of a pretextual stop. Of course, after Brandon and Erickson don't have that issue at all under consideration. But we don't have it in this case. Some of the parade of horrors arguments that were made in the appellee's brief are not under consideration here. It wasn't the reason the officer stopped. When course of a valid stop, items come to light, knowledge comes to the police officer by his observation. This individual is driving under the influence of alcohol. There's a gradual process, as the court pointed out in Robinette. Citing the State versus Eggleston Court of Appeals decision, the Robinette case said you can have a continued detention if it's justified. In this case, clearly, roadside stop and conversation with the driver sitting in the driver's wheel justified every step of continued detention in this case.
But you're not suggesting that just by moving off over the white line, that's a violation under the statute. There's a judgment call here, as nearly as practicable.
Yes, it is a judgment call.
And to stay within the lines, nearly as practicable.
Observing the traffic violation, and in this case, really three cars, and swerving almost all the way to the double yellow, justifies that judgment call in this case. I find it interesting that this court's Harris decision was published, 7 days before Brent's and with virtually the same logic, really the same conclusion that a minor traffic violation based on Delaware versus Krause and all the Berkman versus McCarty and all the following U.S. Supreme Court law.
The U.S. Supreme Court probably didn't know we were taking care of it so well.
No.
I mean, that was it.
No, sometimes it happens.
The way we're reversed by them, it's no wonder. They might think that.
Well,
our criminal case.
Right. Right. That's another consideration. I might digress a little bit. I'll tell you that I advise a police officer in a drug interdiction patrol to do exactly what this court said in Robin F. One. Before your court's decision. And then he called me when the U.S. Supreme Court reversed you, and I told you so. And then I didn't call him back. I didn't call him back after Robin had to, but I wish I had. We point out in this appeal the court below, the majority of the court below, went through a rather tortured reasoning to, as a dissenting judge put it, certain death right there. We submit the court minimized facts that were found by the trial court that there were three line crossings that were swerving as the trial judge put it, drifting back and forth in the lane, which occurred in a quote court below a very short distance. And that brought that case, our case, into line exactly with the State versus Ferris decision of the Fourth District, the only court to see. The majority of the court below reached out to find, as Mr. Giuliano pointed out, Miller agrees that the police officer's car was in this crash. We have evidence to the contrary. The court below seemingly, I'm not sure it meant to do this, but it seemingly required proof of guilt of the Mark Lane violation to this circumstance. That is not required. Trial. The reasonable doubt is our standard, but the reasonable articulable suspicion is less than probable cause. And if we have probable cause, as we do in this case, it more than meets the standard of Terry versus Ohio against John for a temporary detention. I submit that this court should give some guidance to the court below in its decision on the issue of certification. When a court, as the court put in State versus Roberts versus Stevenson, rejecting the Davis action, is an adequate remedy of law if there is a certified conflict to bring that to the attention of this court. Here there's a fundamental difference.
He gave that complete direction in Whitlock versus Gilbane, and it can't be clearer.
Yes.
Okay.
There's a fundamental conflict here. And it's the Fourth Amendment issue, it's a constitutional issue. I submit that the court should reverse the decision of the 12th District majority decision and reinstate the conviction as found by the trial court in the state.
Thank you, Mr. Eichel. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Counsel, or excuse, we have an admission ceremony next, so you may leave. Calendar is the admission on motion of those who have been approved to be admitted on motion. The procedure will be I will ask the presenter one at a time to come to the podium and briefly state why you believe the applicant you are representing would be a good member of the Bar of Ohio. I'll then ask the applicants to come forward and be administered the oath of office by Justice Sweeney. The first presenter is Michael Zeno. If the applicant would please stand in place as you're being introduced, that would help us identify you.
May it please the court. My name is Michael Zeno. I'm an attorney in Ohio since November 1983, and I currently reside in Dahlem. I'm here to present Tina Costa, Christine Costa. She's my sister-in-law, so I prepared a certificate recommending her for admission. I believe that she is of good moral character and a proper person to be admitted to the law of Ohio. She was raised in Ohio and lives in Ohio. There's no question. She graduated from Fort Washington University Law School, and I firmly believe she'll be a credit to our clients on Ohio Bar. I'd like to thank you for being here for such a moment.
Thank you. Paul Doker? Or is it Doker? I have it listed. I have it emphasized here as Doker. Is that the way you pronounce it? Or
no, Your Honor, it's Doker.
That's what I thought, but that's all right.
Good morning, Your Honor. Paul Doker. I've been admitted to the practice of law in the state of Ohio since 1980, February 1980. I practiced on prior occasions with Mr. Sean Patrick Cannon, who is a University of Pittsburgh graduate. I'm not against him. In the cases I've been involved,
some reason, I suspect economic, he went down to Texas and practiced law for 10 years.
Thank you. Is there a motion that the applicants be admitted to the bar?
Move admission.
Hearing no objection, the applicants will please come forward and give us space to prevent you to come beyond the podium. Oath of office will be administered by Justice Sweeney.
Yes, your statement of the following oath indicates that you will either swear or affirm to be bound by that oath. Please raise your right hand. I, and repeat your name, hereby swear or affirm that I will support the Constitution and laws of the United States and the Constitution and laws of the State of Ohio. I will abide by the Code of Professional Responsibility in my capacity as an attorney and officer of the court. I will conduct myself with dignity and civility and show respect towards judges, court staff, clients, fellow professionals, and all other persons. I will honestly, faithfully, and competently discharge the duties of an attorney at law. So help me God. Congratulations.
To congratulate you on behalf of the Bar of Ohio. We have a very strong bar in Ohio, and we hope that it's even better, stronger now that you remember. So good luck. Congratulations. Also, please adjourn court.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the House Supreme Court.